Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we are following news of the dramatic derailment of an Amtrak passenger train this morning near Olympia, south of Seattle in Washington State. The story is still unfolding. There are fatalities. Incredible images of a train car hanging off an overpass over the I-5 freeway. Some train cars fell onto vehicles on the ground below. Here's Pierce County Sheriff spokesman Ed Troyer.
Multiple cars and trucks were struck by train cars that left the train tracks and went down onto the road. The people that were in all the vehicles, even though when you see the pictures, it's pretty horrific, at this point, nobody in any of the vehicles is a fatal. The fatals are all contained to the train. As far as the numbers go, they're still working on that.
Well, and this was the inaugural run of a new trail service in the region. Austin Jenkins of Northwest News Network is at the scene. Austin, what are you seeing?
Well, this is still a very active scene, Robin. This is Interstate 5, the main north-south thoroughfare through Washington State and, for that matter, up and down the West Coast. We're south of Tacoma, north of Olympia, in an area that is very busy during the morning rush hour because of Joint Base Lewis-McChord, a major military installation that is in this area. And as you've described, it is a dramatic scene with these Amtrak Cascades rail cars off the tracks off this trestle or bridge over Interstate 5, and there's at least one car dangling. There's another car on the freeway itself, and as we've been told so far, there are fatalities on the train. We do not have a total number at this point.
Look, we're reading a pretty chilling article from just December 5th, and this was out of Lakewood, Washington, where city leaders there, including the mayor, were very upset about this new, what they called, high-speed train that was set to start today. They feel that some safety measures hadn't been put in. This is, again, on December 5th. They were talking about how trains might be able to go through the city at 79 miles an hour. The mayor of Lakewood said it's just a matter of time before these high-speed trains kill someone. He said, come back when there is that accident and try to justify not putting in those safety enhancements, or go back now and advocate for the money to do it. Again, this was early in the month. Pretty chilling. There were concerns about this train?
Well, that is chilling. And as you know, this is the inaugural trip. I talked to another reporter who was actually on from Seattle down to Tacoma, got off at that point, and then the train continued south to Portland. He said that there were rail buffs, there were dignitaries, and then just passengers who were trying to get south this morning as commuters on this train. Looking at the tracks, it's a new stretch of tracks. The train would have been coming southbound. It's possible that the speeds would have been in the 70 to 80 mile an hour range. I can't confirm that, but it comes around a bend onto that trestle, onto that bridge over I-5, and that's where the derailment happens. So you've got new tracks, a curve, and then this bridge over the interstate where this happened. And there are a lot of unanswered questions at this point about what happened, why this happened, but clearly a catastrophic and premature end to this inaugural ride on this train that was supposed to increase and enhance and speed up passenger service in this area.
It's terrible. I mean, apparently it was supposed to be routed around things like curves and single track tunnels in order to maintain that high speed. Look, meantime, I mean, again, the pictures we're seeing are just terrible. Obviously, fatalities, injuries, but also what a mess. I mean, the traffic's just at a halt.
It is. I mean, we're watching semis being turned around in the southbound lanes of I-5, and they're heading back north in the wrong direction to get them out of here. The State Patrol is indicating that southbound I-5 may be closed or at least impacted for several days to come because of the investigation and the cleanup. And there are also motorists who are driving when the train came flying off the tracks and fell onto the ground. So imagine what they experienced this morning. We're told there are injuries associated with those motorists, but no fatalities among the motorists.
Yeah. Austin Jenkins, a reporter with Northwest News Network. Again, the breaking news is still an ongoing story. An Amtrak train on its inaugural run on this route gone off the tracks. What did you say, Austin? South of Seattle?
South of Tacoma, north of Olympia, just north of the Nisqually River Delta, for those who are familiar with this part of the country.
Yeah. There are fatalities, injuries, and we will keep on this story. Austin, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now we go to Washington, D.C., where it's going to be yet another busy week. Republicans are expected to pass the most significant tax overhaul in 30 years. The House vote is tomorrow. On Wednesday, the Senate votes, and it'll likely be close because Senator John McCain will be home in Arizona, recovering from cancer treatment. Today, President Trump is outlining his national security strategy, and he's also saying that he's not considering firing FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller, even though Trump campaign lawyers claim Mueller's team improperly obtained campaign emails as part of the Russia investigation. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is here to talk about all of this. Ron, start off with Russia. In letters made public this week, the lawyer for the Trump campaign claimed that the FBI improperly obtained emails from the Trump campaign as it investigates possible collusion with Russia. What's the response from the FBI?
The FBI says that they followed all the rules, that they did exactly what they were supposed to do, that the emails were government property. They were reposited on a computer that is run by the General Services Administration of the United States government. All these emails said .gov on them. So there is no question that this was government property, and there is no question that it was all done, if you will, on government computers at taxpayer expense. So that argument doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. The other suggestion that somehow they were already covered by executive privilege would be a stretch also, because the president was not the president yet at the time of these emails being sent. He was not sworn in until famously January 20th of 2017. So while they're making a lot of arguments and they're talking a lot about how they don't like this, it's not clear why they think they really have any legal basis to be upset about having these emails accessed by the special independent counsel, Robert Mueller.
Is it clear what's in the emails?
They seem to have a certain amount to do with all the regular transition business between an outgoing administration and an incoming administration. But clearly, there were some communications that were received from people who were not part of the government, or at least not part of the United States government, our government. One of the things that has been speculated here is that perhaps some of these missives came back and forth between the transition team and representatives of the government of Russia. Representatives of Vladimir Putin, people who had some communication interest in talking to the people who were going to be taking over to the White House.
The Trump campaign advisors, including Kellyanne Conway, has been focusing on these emails and the news last week that an FBI agent on the investigative team wrote some texts that were anti-Trump. Here's what she said on Fox.
The fix was in against Donald Trump from the beginning, and they were pro-Hillary. We understand people have political views, but they are expressing theirs with such animus and venom towards the now president of the United States, they can't possibly be seen as objective or transparent or even-handed or fair.
As Kellyanne Conway spoke, Fox News ran a banner headline posing the question, a coup in America. If Donald Trump at the same time is saying that he is not considering firing Robert Mueller as special counsel, what's the administration's strategy?
The administration's strategy appears to be that in concert with their allies in Congress and their allies in the media, they are undermining faith in the objectivity of Robert Mueller's investigation. Now, this investigation began when Mueller was chosen and appointed by the assistant Attorney General of the United States, Rod Rosenstein, a Republican, who was chosen to serve in that job by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, a former Republican senator and the president's appointee. And that is the line of authority here. And all of these people, including Robert Mueller, are lifelong Republicans. And so to call this a coup d'etat on behalf of Hillary Clinton might seem to be a bit of a stretch. But these are the arguments that we are hearing emerging, including such things as the president cannot commit obstruction of justice, or the president cannot do basically anything wrong. Those kinds of arguments did not work in the Watergate years, and we'll have to see how they fly in the atmosphere of 2017 and 2018, because this is going to be going on for a while.
On Capitol Hill, looks as if the House vote is tomorrow on tax reform, the Senate on Wednesday. Does it look, from your point of view, as if it's all but ready to go to the president's desk?
Yes, it does. It would appear the vote would be something like 51 to 48, with all 48 Democrats and independents against, and all 51 Republicans answering the roll call in favor. John McCain has gone home to Arizona for some further treatment for his cancer. There is the possibility that another Republican senator might not necessarily get there, but we are expecting the other 51 to be there and to vote yes. Now, there are a couple who have not yet entirely signed on, and there are a couple who might still have a couple of question marks over their heads, but every time we see somebody say they're really not sure how they're going to vote, they wind up voting for it. So right at this point, we're expecting something right around 50 or 51 votes for and 48 votes against.
Meanwhile, lawmakers have not yet agreed on a way to avoid a government shutdown Friday night. Where do things stand?
Things are quite confused with regard to the government shutdown. We had expected that they would simply pass another continuing resolution, which is their way of postponing the moment of reckoning, kick it a couple of weeks into January. After all, everyone wants to go home for the holidays. And this kind of pressure that they use to get Congress to focus, to get Congress to settle down and actually compromise and make a deal, hasn't worked so far since the fiscal year ended on September 30th. But the hope was that maybe Christmas would raise the ante enough that people would actually do it. So far, we don't see the deal. The Democrats have one strategy to get there. The Republicans have another. The Senate has one plan. The House has yet another. And so they've only got a few days to resolve it, and right now everyone's focused on the tax bill. So it's conceivable this could get sticky by Thursday.
Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
That's music from the new film, The Greatest Showman. The movie was inspired by the life of Barnum & Bailey Circus founder P.T. Barnum. Over a century ago, the circus was one of America's most popular forms of entertainment. The circus sideshow was also a huge draw. People would save their pennies to see acts such as The Bearded Lady and The Conjoined Twins. Author Beth Macy explored the sideshow world in her acclaimed 2016 book, True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, A True Story of the Jim Crow South. The book tells the story of George and Willie Muse, two boys who were lured into the circus as sideshow attractions in 1899. Earlier this year, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus shut down, in part because of concerns over the welfare of performing animals. But as Beth Macy told me, in the days she was writing about, the situation was far different.
Long before we worried about people exploiting animals, I mean, they were exploiting people in the sideshow, and chief among them were African Americans, people with disabilities, people thought to be fodder for people's entertainment to look at.
Could you read a little bit from the book?
Sure.
And maybe set it up for us, Beth.
Okay. So in this section, I'm describing the way the trains would roll into town. They said that the circus was like a moving city at night. They would pack up at the end of a show, and then they would go on to the next venue. And when they would wake up, it would be dawn. And people would come out, people who couldn't afford a ticket for the circus, they were called the lot lice. They would set their alarms to be there at 6 a.m. when the circus would unload. Because if you couldn't afford a ticket, you could at least for free see all the acts as they were coming off the trains, like just dozens and dozens of train cars. So I'm trying to describe how the sideshow fit into this. I say, picture a single car, usually somewhere near the front of the train, full of human misfits, a bearded lady, a skeleton man, a conjoined twin complaining that she hadn't slept because her sister was tossing and turning all night. The freaks, people called them, in politically incorrect language that fit right in with other offensive circus lingo, which was fine by most of the freaks because, well, they had their own pride of calling, too. As the art photographer Diane Arbus once said of sideshow performers, quote, most people go through life dreading they'll have a traumatic experience. Freaks were born with their trauma. They've passed their test in life. They're aristocrats.
There was a certain kind of act they were looking for, a certain kind of person. And you go into this saying that the circus operators wanted to make sure somebody wasn't totally pitiable, but that they had an obvious difference from the quote-unquote normal person, and that they could do something that was to be admired, some kind of talent.
They had to have a talent. They had to be different and unusual to look at, not something you would see just every day in your daily lives. They had to be not offensive. So the fat lady had to be curvaceous, but still really pretty in the face. And a family of dwarves that could also sing. That was the other thing they wanted. They wanted people to have a skill so that when you came into the sideshow tent, the lecturer would take you by every act and introduce them. Then they would either answer questions about their disability or they would perform. So there was a man who could put like 38 little ping pong balls in his mouth. Somebody else could blow smoke out of his eyes. They would present their skill.
And the person giving the spiel, the lecturer, would also, I mean, make things up out of whole cloth about where people came from. And this is what I want you to talk about right now. The two people who were at the center of the story that you wrote, a sideshow act made up of two African-Americans, Willie and George Muse. They were from a place called Truvine in Virginia. They were in a family of sharecroppers. They were African-American, but they had another visible difference.
Right. They had albinism. And so that meant that they were legally blind at birth and they have very light skin, but otherwise they had African-American features. And what the circus did is they exaggerated their features. So they had them grow their hair out long and they put them into dreadlocks before anybody knew what dreadlocks were. So they sort of exploded. The dreadlocks were sort of gathered at the crown of their head and they sort of exploded like fireworks. And dressed them in really kind of exotic costumes that matched whatever name they were calling them by at the time. So their most common name was Eco and Ico, ambassadors from Mars, and they were said to have been discovered coming out of a wrecked spaceship in the Mojave Desert.
When in actuality it was several miles away on a farm that they may have been taken from or lured away from when they were working outside in the field, or the way other stories go, their mother may have actually contracted or leased them to the circus for a certain amount of time.
Initially, yes. And if that's the case, and it was never anything I could quite pin down, but there is some likelihood that perhaps she initially let them go. She was expecting them to be returned, and then we know that they were trafficked unpaid for a period of at least 13 years.
Unpaid?
Unpaid.
They didn't get any money. They could send no money home.
They were told their mother was dead and to quit asking to go home and to quit crying. And so when she finally files a lawsuit to get justice for her family after she gets them back, she's able to prove that they've been unpaid for a period of at least the last 7 years that they've been with Ringling Brothers at the time. So she wins a settlement.
And that is an amazing part of the story, just that this African-American woman who was exceedingly poor, didn't have a lot of resources, was able to get these two back. Hold that thought, because I want to get back to exactly what life was like for these participants in the sideshow. We say participants, but really they didn't have much choice at that point.
I don't think they were all pulled in against their will. The thing is about, you never know whether to believe the accounts because there is so much tricksterism and fakery. And sometimes the sideshow bands were usually made up of African-American performers, many of them from New Orleans. And to pick up extra money, they would take side gigs pretending to be savages that had been discovered from an African country. And they called this is, I'm going to go get my Zulu ticket this summer, my side job, pretending to be somebody discovered in the wilds of Africa. One of the things that people in the sideshow would always say was that people were laughing at us in the audience, but we were laughing at them backstage because they were paying money to see us. So in almost every account that you read, and even from people who I talked to that were in sideshows, there was this pride of calling, too, that they made a pretty good living. They weren't institutionalized. And those who were treated with respect were kind of proud of the work that they did. And once the Muse brothers were able to be paid, they actually got to experience a lot that they might not have if they had stayed home in Roanoke, Virginia, where they lived in abject poverty, where their family lived in abject poverty.
It's one of the fascinating things about this whole story that eventually, you know, when George and Willie's mother was able to get them out of the circus, they lived in very cramped quarters. They at one point would work for money by singing in a window of a local drugstore. They were good musicians, right?
They were good musicians, but one gentleman who was still alive when I was reporting on this book, he no longer is, he said they looked really sad to him. And they actually realized they were more comfortable with the sideshow people than they were at home, especially once they knew their mother was alive and they could come home to visit her in the off season. And they were contributing to their family's economy.
And so they really did buy in at that point, and they liked having an audience.
You know, it's great to be good at something, and it makes you feel good to be good at what you do. And I think the music gave them just untold amounts of joy. At the end of his life, Willie lived to be 108. He was still singing the songs he had learned during the 19-teens, little pop songs from the 19-teens and 20s.
You know, it's so easy to be revolted by the very concept of a sideshow and the kind of exploitation that was built in. But as you discovered in the story of George and Willie Mews, it wasn't entirely bad for the people who were in it. But what transpired to make it unpopular, the sideshow unpopular, and kind of a mirror of what's happened with animal acts in the circus today?
Exactly. I mean, you're right. We're almost revolted to hear about such things today. So they retire in the early 1960s, and because of how their mother had advocated, they had basically a house bought and paid for in their names. And they end up retiring at the same time in history that we start caring about disability rights, and the sideshow slowly fades away. And so their careers very much mirror the last 50 years of the sideshow. I mean, it was kind of at its peak when they first got going, and then by the time they retire, it's going away.
I'd like to end with a piece of music that you were able to get from Willie Mews's great-niece. Her name is Nancy Saunders.
Yes.
And she gave this to you and set it up for us.
Sure. So this is a song that George and Willie learned in the mid-teens when they were first on the road. It was a World War I anthem about missing home. And Willie used to say when he was sad at night, crying, missing his mother, they would sing this song and his brother would tell him, "Don't worry, I know she's alive. I know we're going to see her one day." And so at the end of his life, when he's 108 and he's totally blind by this point, he has a picture of his mother up next to his bed and he straightens it every night, even though he can no longer see it. And he's still singing this song that meant so much to him, that harken back to this idea that we will be okay and we will see our mother again. And so Nancy got him to record it around when he was about 102 or 3.
This is the late 1990s.
Yeah, wow. He didn't die until 2001.
We'll play it now. Beth Macy, author of True Vine, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, my Piccalilli, farewell us to square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
Interview first aired in July. True Vine is now out in paperback, and there's a film with Leonardo DiCaprio in the works.
President Trump is calling his $1.5 trillion Republican tax overhaul the best Christmas present of all. It could be on his desk for a signature by the end of the week. It is the most significant change to the U.S. tax code in more than 30 years, but critics say it's a gift for some, but a lump of coal for others. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off, joins us. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So we're going to keep doing this, I think, for weeks, just look at different parts of this hundreds and hundreds of pages of tax plan. But start with people already thinking about preparing taxes, you know, for next year. How hard is it going to be? How different is it going to be?
You know, it really depends on who you are, how much money you earn, how you earn your money, where you live. Do you take itemized deductions? I think that the best advice is to kind of breathe a little bit and pull your last year's tax returns out. That's going to be a big enough task for some people. Just to say, let me look at it and let me look at what last year looked like for myself. Did I itemize? Did I take the standard deduction? And familiarize yourself with this because, frankly, a lot of people are sort of disconnected from what this process means.
Well, especially if you have someone else do it. Now, the new plan almost doubles the standard deduction for married couples. It goes from about $12,000 to $24,000. So what's the impact there? How will that impact whether or not people itemize?
Well, you know, right now, about 70% of taxpayers take the standard deduction, and that amount is probably going to go up to over 85%. That should make their lives, whoever is claiming that standard deduction, somewhat easier. But the best way to think about the standard deduction is to see how it plays with two other things that happened in this new bill, and that is that we got rid of the personal exemption. That's current law where individuals got $4,050 $1,000 for each of the people in the family. So we got rid of that personal exemption. And some people might say, oh my God, that's terrible because I claim my kids as personal exemptions. But you also get this new child tax credit. So I think that when you put these three things together, a doubling of the standard deduction, loss of personal exemptions, and increase in the child tax credit, many families will do better off, at least for the next 8 years. Remember, most of these provisions on the individual side, they go away after 2025.
Yeah, and I think Republicans are counting on Democrats, if they are in power in 8 years, not overturning that. But staying with some of the thoughts here, homeowners can still deduct mortgage interest for loans of up to $750,000. But the real estate industry says the bill will cool demand for housing. Now, we should say it's thought that the biggest benefit out of this plan goes to commercial real estate, which, of course, the Trumps are very involved in. But talk about just, you know, people, homeowners.
Okay. So first of all, if you're panicking right now, this is grandfathering in your current home mortgage. Okay. So don't freak out. You're allowed to deduct your home mortgage interest on debt up to $1 million currently. Now, the new plan would mean that you could only deduct a mortgage interest up to $750,000. So if you live in an area where there's high-priced homes and people use big mortgages, this could essentially start to change the dynamics of those areas. Some economists are saying we could see a reduction of up to 10% in house prices in those areas. It will be neighborhood by neighborhood. Everyone take a deep breath. It's not all happening. You don't have to do anything right away.
And we didn't do it all today, but we'll keep doing it. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Sure. Take care.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for attacks in Afghanistan and Pakistan in the past 2 days, and the Taliban carried out a deadly attack in southern Afghanistan yesterday. The violence comes as President Trump unveils his national security strategy today. Michael Kugelman is deputy director of the Asia program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He was in the region last month and joins us now from Washington. Michael, what is the importance of the area around the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan to U.S. national security?
Well, the Afghanistan-Pakistan region is really one of the most volatile regions in the world. And I think that given that the chief U.S. Interest in South Asia is stability, the fact that you have rampant instability throughout much of Afghanistan and much of Pakistan as well suggests that U.S. interests are very much imperiled in a part of the world where, you know, lest we forget, America has been fighting its longest ever foreign war for the last 17 years.
But the United States has also been counting on both certainly Afghanistan and Pakistan. Pakistan may be better prepared to counter the what's happening on the ground, extremism there. What is happening? You were in an area called North Waziristan, the Pakistani tribal region that borders Afghanistan. What did you see and what did you find?
What I saw in North Waziristan was very surreal. I mean, this is a region that's long been regarded as one of the most dangerous parts of the world simply because it has attracted all types of different terrorist groups from Al-Qaeda to local terror groups like the Taliban. What I saw is a fair degree of stabilization in the very small amount of the city of Miran Shah in North Waziristan that I saw.
Stabilization because of Pakistani counterterrorism efforts?
Yeah, the Pakistani army launched an operation in North Waziristan about 3 years ago to go after the Pakistani Taliban, which has carried out the majority of the terror attacks in Pakistan really over the last decade. And it's been effective in the sense that terrorist attacks have gone down. And the fact that I was able to be there, that the Pakistani military was felt comfortable bringing an American foreign affairs analyst to see the progress on the ground, I think that speaks to something. But at the same time, we really need to caveat this issue. Yes, on the one hand, you know, I saw, you know, all kinds of development. There are new hospitals being built, new roads, things like that. But clearly, there was more than met the eye. I saw a very small part of North Waziristan. And, you know, the terrorism remains a major problem, not too far from what the area that I had seen. In fact, there were several terrorist attacks in North Waziristan just over the last week to 10 days.
I know that you've said you were struck by how easily progress made, and you're talking about some of that progress, could be squandered thanks to the what you call the enduring appeal of extremism in the area. What is the appeal?
Well, the fact of the matter is that hardline, hateful ideologies have made major inroads in Pakistan in recent years. I mean, you have children going to school and public schools, and they open their textbooks, and what they find in there is just a lot of nasty stuff said about members of religious minorities, India, Israel, the United States. You have very influential religious leaders, clerics, who in their weekly sermons spout a lot of hate. And what really struck me, what I found so ironic about my trip to North Waziristan, is that a group of religious hardliners, extremists, were planning a protest in Islamabad. Roads were shut down in Islamabad, which almost prevented me from getting over to the helipad in Islamabad that was going to take me to see this so-called counterterrorism progress. So in effect, you know, my trip to see progress with the terrorism problem was nearly imperiled by religious extremists, and I find that a bit ironic.
Why are both things allowed?
Unfortunately, in Pakistan, these religious hardliners have outsized influence. You know, the protesters that eventually made it to Islamabad and essentially camped out in the middle of the city for 2 weeks, there were only a few thousand of them. But I think that the government and the state on the whole, it treats them with kid gloves and is very worried. It knows that many Pakistanis across the board are receptive to ideologies of hate. And I think that you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of hesitation on the part of the state to confront that type of thing.
But why is that? I mean, why? What would be the attractiveness to Pakistan, especially since it's under this pressure from the United States as well as others? What would be the interest in overlooking or condoning these actions?
Well, I think the broader context is important here. Pakistan, and particularly the security establishment, the military, has been willing to provide space, a sanctuary, and support to certain types of extremist organizations, including terrorist organizations such as the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani Network. Essentially, these groups help serve Pakistan's interests by keeping Pakistan's enemy, India, at bay in Afghanistan. And so I think that you know, the Pakistani military is not willing to confront groups like that, even though, as you note, the U.S. Government has for years been demanding that the U.S. act against them. And the Trump administration has really amped up the pressure by threatening to take unprecedented punitive measures to try to punish Pakistan if the Pakistanis don't respond, though I'm not particularly optimistic that the Pakistanis will respond in the way that the Americans want them to.
Michael, unpack what you said a little bit more there, that it serves at least the Pakistani military purpose to let some of this extremism happen because they want to keep India at bay in Afghanistan. How do you mean that?
Pakistan worries that India will try to use Afghanistan as a space to plan nefarious acts inside Pakistan. Now, in my view, there's very little clear evidence that this is actually happening or that it would happen. But, you know, Pakistan really worries that India would try to increase its presence in Afghanistan, giving it an opportunity to do that. And groups like the Haqqani Network, sure, they go after Afghans, they go after U.S. and foreign forces, but they also go after Indian targets. They've targeted Indian consulates in Afghanistan before. So, you know, my point here is that, unfortunately, a terrorist group like the Haqqani Network serves as a useful asset to the Pakistanis because it helps promote their interests by minimizing or reducing the likelihood that India could deepen its presence inside Afghanistan, even though India and Afghanistan have a pretty deep relationship and India has long provided a lot of development and diplomatic support to Afghanistan.
And the Haqqani Network being one of the extremist groups in the area. What is the United States' involvement there directly on the ground? How to what extent are U.S. forces engaged there right now along this border?
Well, I mean, the U.S. presence, the military presence is on the Afghan side of the border, of course. It's been fighting a war for 17 years. And the majority, I mean, the major component of this war in Afghanistan, really for the last 3 years, has been to provide training and advising to Afghan security forces. And I think that the Trump administration's Afghanistan strategy is really banking on a very risky and shaky assumption, and that is essentially that by putting more military pressure on the Taliban and by going after them harder on the battlefield, that eventually they'll beat the Taliban down enough that the Taliban would be willing to step off the battlefield and agree to launch a reconciliation process with the Afghan government that would end the war. But I say that's very risky because we've tried it before. We tried it when we had more than 100,000 U.S. troops on the ground during the height of the U.S. troop surge in 2010, 2011. It didn't work then, so I don't see why it would necessarily work now when we only have 13, 14,000 U.S. troops on the ground.
Final question. What is your takeaway from your trip to the region that you would hope would inform Washington as it looks at strategy for 2018?
You know, what I saw really solidified what so many of us in Washington have long suspected, and that is that Pakistan does take action against terrorist groups of a certain type, the type that stage attacks against Pakistan. And that's why, you know, what I saw on the ground in North Waziristan was evidence that Pakistan had gone after the likes of the Pakistani Taliban. But there was no evidence that the Pakistanis had really done much at all to deal with the problem of the Haqqani network, which had a presence, a very considerable presence, in the very roads that I was traveling on when I was in North Waziristan. You know, when military officials that I was with were asked, what happened to the Haqqani network? They basically were very vague and said that it had basically just melted away. And I think that's basically confirmed for myself that, you know, the focus of this counterterrorism operation in North Waziristan was to go after a terrorist group of a certain type, and something that's much appreciated by the government here in Washington. But at the end of the day, the U.S. government wants Pakistan to do more. But whether Pakistan does do more, I think, is very unlikely.
Good to talk to you. Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He was recently in the volatile tribal region between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you.
And our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has been making a list and checking it twice. It's her annual list of favorite cookbooks. And Lisa and I love that she cooks up some of the recipes for us.
Yeah.
People, these are incredible. But Kathy, first tell me, what were you looking for in the books this year?
Well, it's really a tough job. And I'm not kidding. I go through dozens and dozens of books. And every year, they're just these stunning books. This year, I had three things I was looking for. I wanted to learn about a new culture, a new cuisine, or a new ingredient. Mm-hmm. Always I want good food writing. A great collection of recipes is so crucial to a cookbook, but if it's well written, it's a big bonus in my book. And I wanted to be inspired. Even me, who cooks every day and thinks about food pretty much in her sleep, I get dulled out. I get like, oh, I'm not feeling it. Mm-hmm. So I wanted inspiration. So I started the journey in Turkey. Robin Eckhart wrote a stunning new book called Istanbul and Beyond, Exploring the Diverse Cuisines of Turkey. And from her book, I made an ambitious recipe. It's a savory, coiled fennel and nigella bun. It's a yeast dough that gets sesame seeds, fennel seeds, and black nigella seeds, which are really delicious, like a sesame seed, but not sweet at all.
Can you get this stuff? I mean, is that...
Absolutely. Yeah. And we can, if you go online, you can find it also. But I'm finding it in stores quite easily more and more. Eckhart and her husband traveled around Turkey from the markets to the ocean, and the chapter titles alone clue you in as to what a unique book this is. One chapter is called Olives, Pomegranates, and Chilies. Another one is called Urfa Peppers and Silk Road Spices. Mm. So they're exotic, but they're not all difficult, but I am in love with that bun. Isn't that delicious?
It's amazing. It's coiled like as if you took a piece of rope and coiled it around.
Yeah, it almost reminded me of an inverse pretzel. It's really fun to make.
And it's not too heavy on the fennel, which for non-fennel people like me.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
It's delicious.
You get a hint of it.
So if you're looking for different cultures, that explains why you chose the second book. This is a book about the cooking goddess Paula Wolford,
exactly,
who is so fantastic, who spent a lot of time in Morocco. And so this is Paula herself?
Yeah. It's a biography. It's a culinary biography. It's called Unforgettable, The Bold Flavors of Paula Wolford's Renegade Life by Emily Kaiser Thielen. And it is a very spectacular tribute. Just want to read you one line. "Good food is memory," writes Paula Wolford. But as Emily Thielen writes in this unusual biography / cookbook, quote, "Paula was known for her keen memory. At the peak of her career, she could recreate whole recipes from two scribbled lines. She could take one bite of a flatbread in Tunisia and compare the leavening equivalents in Egypt, Turkey, or Israel. Mm-hmm. But now, at age 73, she struggles to remember the basics of any of them. In 2013, she received a diagnosis of dementia, probably Alzheimer's." So this is a tribute to Wolford and her gorgeous career, her brilliant recipes, but it's also very much about her illness. In addition to following her life and the shrimp you have there.
Oh, it's
five
so spicy
ingredients. It is so stunning. It's sizzling shrimp with garlic and pimenton, which is a smoky Spanish paprika. And man, that dish, I mean, I want it every day.
Is it in olive oil?
It's in olive oil with garlic, a little chili pepper, and the spicy paprika. I love so many of the recipes in here. And at the end, there's even tips for 7 keys to reviving food memory and Paula's tips for dementia worriers and warriors. It's a love story.
Wow.
It's really beautiful.
So we'll have the recipe and more about the book at herenow.org. It is incredible. But the third book we want to get to, it's from New York Times food writer Melissa Clark. You tried to ignore it?
Why? I did. I'll tell you why. I'm always looking to discover new food writers who have strong voices and aren't as well known. And Melissa Clark, as many people know, is in the New York Times every Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the book and I'm like, okay, it's a beautiful book, but no, I'm not going to give Melissa Clark more attention. But it is such a wonderful book, as this roasted winter vegetable dish with an herbed buttermilk dressing lets you know. There's crispy roasted kale. There's little diced sweet potato or potato and butternut.
There was.
Robin's loving this vegetable dish. And then you make this fabulous dressing with herbs or bitter greens, mint, arugula, parsley, basil, and then you add toasted chopped walnuts on top. This is the book for people who are saying every Tuesday night, what do I cook? I don't have a lot of time. What do I put on the table? And she really nails it.
It's amazing. So you've got Dinner Changing the Game from Melissa Clark, Unforgettable, The Bold Flavors of Paula Wolford's Renegade Life, a biography cookbook, Istanbul and Beyond, Exploring the Diverse Cuisines of Turkey. And can we add Kathy's latest book, Soup SWAT?
Wow, how nice of you to mention it.
It's amazing. Comforting. Did I say SWAT?
Don't SWAT.
Soup SWAP. Comforting recipes to make and share. Kathy, thanks as always. Incredible gift ideas and good food.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. Jeremy is back tomorrow. This is Here and Now.
Let's eat.